This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, many children in inner cities are heading back to schools that are run down, unsafe, and underfunded. With many urban public schools doomed to fail, it often helps to hear the stories of educators who have made their schools work. My guest Madeline Cartwright tells one such story in her new book, For the Children. Cartwright spent 11 years as the principal of the Blaine Elementary School in the heart of North Philadelphia, which she describes as the poorest and most dangerous part of the city. Under her leadership, the school started winning attendance awards for both students and teachers. Hundreds of parents showed up for the meetings she organized. Philadelphia newspaper articles and editorials praised her leadership. Cartwright briefly took over a junior high school after Blaine and then headed up a program to involve parents in the city's schools. This year, she isn't heading back to school. She's retired. I asked her to remember back to 1979 when she became the principal at Blaine and to describe the physical state of the school then.
Okay, when I came into Blaine, the school was not clean. There were roaches walking as if they were on roll, and mice the same way. The walls were cinder block. There was dirt in the little cracks in the cinder block. The floors, an inch, two from the floor, from the walls, was just black, black, black. It was just a dirty, dirty place. And it was all right. It was all right with everybody.
Everybody was just reconciled.
The teacher's lounge had a sink with no faucet. The faucet didn't work. The stove in the teacher's lounge was just downright filthy. But it was all right.
Your desk, the principal's desk, had roaches in it.
Yeah, that's a funny thing. There were roaches inside the desk drawers. And also in the telephone. I banged the telephone down one day, and roaches jumped out of the telephone. And I got right up quickly. That's another thing, too, is I have no tolerance for bugs. None. So that right there made me know something had to happen.
What did you see as your role as principal in getting the school physically cleaned up?
I knew I could. I knew that as principal, I had the authority to clean it. And along with the authority was the responsibility to clean it up. So I began then saying that children have no business in a place that's this dirty. And we have to clean it.
Tell a story about how you clean the bathroom.
Okay, I went into the boys' room, and I had spoken to the custodian about it, and he had cleaned it, quote around cleaned. When I came back into it, I could still smell the odor. The stench was just so strong. So I said to him, "This bathroom needs to be cleaned." He said, "I just cleaned it." I said, "You couldn't have cleaned it. It's still nasty." So he said, the urine is in the cement. It won't come out." I said, "Now, mister, it is not in the cement. It will come out." So I said, "You go give me a bucket of water and a brush, and I'll show you what come out." He went to get the bucket of water and the brush. I took off my stockings and my shoes so I could reuse water freely and not worry about ruining my shoes. He came back with the bucket, and I took the brush, and I scrubbed the walls around the toilet. I scrubbed all around the toilet and the floors and kept dumping plenty of water. When I finished, there was no odor in that bathroom at all. I turned to him and said, "Do you smell anything?" He looked at me and said, "No, ma'am." And he knew right then I wanted the bathrooms cleaned. And from then on, he cleaned the bathrooms.
Now, what did you think the wisdom was of you, the new principal, taking off her shoes and stockings and getting on her hands and knees to scrub the boys' room?
It had to say to the folks that I wanted it to be right. And whatever I had to do to bring about the change I wanted, I was willing to do that. And I'd be expecting everybody else to do whatever they had to do to bring about the change we wanted.
Now, that included spending 1 month of the summer with as many parents as you could recruit, cleaning the rest of the school.
That's right. I came to the school in March. So in June, when we had the little graduation ceremony for the little kids who were leaving in the sixth grade, all the parents came. Now, that's one place you could look for parents, is for this little graduation, we called it. All the parents were there. And I talked to them about having visited the McDonald's restaurant and how clean it was. And I said, "Kids don't have to come there. But here they have to come, and there's no reason that this school can't be as clean as any restaurant or any hospital that you enter, and we have to clean it." And I said, "Can I get somebody to help me?" I said, "Because I know how many people still have kids in the school." They raised their hands. I said, "I know those folks with their hands. Keep your hands up. The folks with your hands up. I know you don't want your kids in a dirty school, do you?" "No, we don't." Will you help me clean it?" "Keep your hands up. Will you help me clean it?" Then I had somebody run around and take their names. And that's all we did. That's all we did. And then we told them that on July 1st, we were going to commence cleaning that school. Without calling another parent or anything, on July 1st, when I showed up at that school, there were 17 parents standing there with pails in their hands waiting to clean that building.
Now, what do you think the final value was of cleaning up the bathrooms and then having parents come in to clean up the rest of the school, did it change the students or the parents or the teachers' attitudes about school?
Yeah, I think there was an adjustment there for everybody. I think that when the teachers came back in September, the building was clean, and I mean clean. We had taken paint scrapers and egg turners and scraped wax up off of that floor that had been there for 10 years. We cleaned it spotless. We washed the windows in the office. We put Venetian blinds on the windows. We painted the office furniture bright green, and we had little toys hanging from the ceiling. It just was a beautiful, it rivaled McDonald's. When the teachers came in, they looked to see that this is going to be different. But still, that was the office. Many schools had clean offices. But as the teachers left their rooms and walked down the hallways to see the hallway was spotless clean, when they got in their own classrooms, they saw that the classrooms they left were not the classrooms they reentered. In Philadelphia, you don't get a new shade on the window unless the shade tears up and won't go up and down. But here they had, we took all the shades down. The shades are very good material. They'll wash. They're washed like oilcloth. We took them down, put them on the floor, scrubbed them, hosed them, put them back. So they walked into sparkling, clean rooms. They knew that here is a person who said the children have to be respected by coming into a clean place. And they knew that if we had worked that hard all summer, that we meant for children to be respected.
Now, did you get paid for that month that you worked?
Oh, no. Well, we got paid in no money. But we got paid in learning to know the parents, and they got to know me, and they spread it out through the neighborhood that she's just like we are. We can trust her. We can trust her. She's the same as we are. That, I think, is a problem with schools. We don't trust. Back and forth. We don't trust the parents. Parents don't trust us. We're afraid to touch kids, afraid the parents are going to sue us. Parents don't know if we're going to turn them into the welfare, call the police, using them for one thing or another. I mean, what's your real motive here? Can't be to help me. You must be using me for something. So it's trust that we built.
What role did you want your school to play in the lives of the children and their families?
I wanted the school to educate the children, but I also wanted the school to serve the children and their families. You know, I had families in the Blaine area who did not know how to turn a telephone on, who did not know how to return a purchase for something that had broken or torn, that buy a jacket, the zipper breaks, throw it in the corner, and save money for another one. And I wanted to show them that they could live, fix the jacket, take it back. I wanted to show them all the things that my mother knew, for whatever reason she knew. I think her mother might have told her. But she knew how to repair and how to make do. We had 12 children during the Depression, and we made do. And I wanted to show them that as hard as it was, they could make do and they could be proud. And that I thought the school could help do.
Now, one of the things you did, and this is a kind of almost legendary story now. The washing machine, right. You brought in a washing machine, a dryer, and a sewing machine into the school. Why did you do that?
That was the same reason. To show parents that you could wash clothes and keep them. You could sew something that tore and keep it, not replace it. And then also, too, is to have youngsters walk into that building in the morning and look good. If a youngster came in whose clothing was not clean, we took him into the dressing room, took off his clothes, her clothes, washed them up good, gave them our clothes to put on, fixed their little hair. And while they were gone, we sewed their clothes if they were torn, put them in the washing machine, washed them, gave them back to them at the end of the day. So the youngsters knew they could feel good in school all day. And my kids looked good every day, all day. If their hair wasn't fixed, we fixed it. Whatever a youngster needed to walk up those stairs feeling good about himself, we provided that for him.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Madeline Cartwright, and her new book, For the Children, is in part about her decade as principal of an elementary school in Philadelphia's inner city. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Madeline Cartwright. She was a teacher in the Philadelphia school system for about 17 years. For about a decade, she was the principal of an elementary school in Philadelphia's inner city. And now she heads a parent involvement program for the city of Philadelphia. She's written a new book called For the Children. Now, the neighborhood that your school was in was a pretty dangerous neighborhood, a lot of crime in the neighborhood. What did you do to keep the school safe? Safe, you know, protected from outside danger and also protected from bullies within the school.
Okay, then the outside part of the school, I talked to the children. I never walked anywhere through that neighborhood and passed a soul that I didn't say good morning to and insist that they say good morning back. If I passed anybody and I said, good morning, they didn't answer, I'd say, excuse me, do you see me? Did I speak to you? Sometimes I'd let them pass me without speaking. And once they pass me, I'd say, do I look like a tree or a car? Come back and say, good morning, I'm a person. We speak to each other. So that I knew the entire neighborhood, and I walked the neighborhood often, so that I got to know everybody who lived in the perimeter of that school. So everybody knew us. So it wasn't a thing where we were afraid of the folks, and they weren't afraid of us. I mean, they kind of respected that. That's another thing, too. As I said to them, don't steal anything from this building. If you steal it, you've got it one time. If you don't steal it, it's here for you to use. Whatever you need, if I have it, you can use it. If you're going to have a party, you need a record player, come over, borrow it, use it, bring it back. It's here for somebody else and here for you. If you need a table, no problem. Come over, take your legs off the table, take it to your place. My custodian will go, put the legs back on, go take them off and bring them back. So that everybody began to feel like the school really was theirs. We didn't have a problem with outside. With the inside, I insisted that there be no fighting. You must not fight. You must not fight. And invariably, when they fought, I'd say, well, don't you know that we have a rule not to fight? Why didn't you tell your teacher? Well, she wasn't going to do anything about it. And I said, well, how do you know what she would do?
Well, she didn't do anything before.
And I said, well, what did you do before? When she didn't do anything, what did you do? You should have come to me. I said, you have to go to the immediate person who's there. If they don't do anything, then you go to the next person. And eventually you come to me. I will do something. You absolutely must not fight. And we held forth to that. And if there were a fight, I was right there on it. And I made sure that teachers responded to the needs of the children.
You know, I think a typical way of dealing with somebody who is a real bully in the school is that they step far out of line. You suspend them, kick them out for a few weeks. You ban suspensions in the school.
Well, I felt that suspension, as I viewed it, should have been time for a child to go home, talk with his parents about the problem, some kind of a free time for the parent to be with the child away from the other children to discuss the problems and to see how they could remedy it. I didn't see that happening in the years that I taught in Philadelphia. I taught 17 years before becoming principal. I would see a youngster suspended, and the next day he's riding a bicycle all around through the kids while they're playing recess. So the suspension wasn't doing what I thought it should do. Also, I saw many homes not capable of giving the kind of lessons that we wanted for suspension. So rather than take a chance for a youngster, maybe his mother was working, for a youngster to be home by himself being suspended, or taking a chance of a youngster going home and not serving what I wanted to serve, I didn't suspend them. I said, you have a right to education. You have to come to school. I come. That the only time you'll be suspended from Blaine is if you are a clear and present danger to yourself while in the building, other children, teacher, or us. Then I'll suspend you. And so, I weighed 200 pounds.
So what did you think appropriate punishment was for a bully or for someone who just acts up constantly and disrupts the class?
Most often, if I brought a youngster down to the office and I said, we had a pledge, we said, that I will act in such a way that I will be proud of myself and others will be proud of me too. I came to school to learn and I will learn. I will have a good day. So when the youngsters came, I'd say, well, did you say your pledge this morning? Let me hear you say it. He'd say it. And I said, well, you think I'm proud of this? Are you proud of yourself? Well, no. Do you think I'm proud? Your mother would be proud? Oh, no. Well, as soon as the youngster broke down, then you knew right then punishment was enough right there. He had realized that he had done something wrong, that he was ready to make amends. The youngsters got so they just wanted me to love them. They wanted our approval. And they stayed in line. When they came out of line, there were punishments that we had. We didn't allow them to go to recess. We may have kept them after school. We may not have. I did not allow the keeping from a trip. Every youngster had to go on every trip. A trip to me was an educational experience, and you can't punish you. The same as sending you home. If I'm sending you home, I'm stopping you from being educated. It's not the way to do it. And then sometimes, if a youngster just was too far out of hand, I couldn't bring him back in hand, I would say to him, what does your mother do? And he would say, well, my mother will spank me. And I would say, let me call your mother, and I'll call her, and maybe she'll spank you, and that'll help. Well, no, please don't do that. And I would say, why? And then I would listen to them. Sometimes I would spank them. And I would spank them because I would have them bend over the chair and I'd hit them two times, never more than three. And that would maybe turn them around. If they left out of the classroom, they would say, well, I'll see you later, Miss Cartwright. You see, it wasn't such a thing. It was like I was angry with them and didn't like them. It was that this was a punishment that went along with this infraction. And basically that was for hitting other children. Because the kids seemed like if someone hit them, they weren't happy unless someone hit him back. They felt like they had to do something. A hit had to be for a hit.
Now, you weren't worried about a lawsuit of a parent going to the superintendent of school saying, the principal of this school hit my child.
Yeah.
Because parents often think that their children are incapable of doing wrong, right?
Yeah, and that was a chance that I had to take. That was a chance that I had to take. And I took that chance. It never happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I took that chance because the children felt that if someone hit them and no one hit him back, that he was just not satisfied. And I said to them that I will satisfy you. It's not necessary for you to take law in your own hands. And I went on and tried that. And I got through it. Yeah.
Now, you say something very interesting in your book about controlling students. You say you can't control inner city kids through intimidating them. You
right.
can't control them through fear.
Mm-hmm. See, you know, and the same thing, too, is you talk about controlling children. And what you have to do is support youngsters in the understanding that this is unacceptable behavior.
Well,
this behavior is unacceptable.
Why won't fear work, first of all? Why won't fear work as a disciplinary tool?
Well, listen, fear is not going to work because what are you going to do to a child that will frighten him when he has walked through 10 stories of a project building where I'm afraid to go into projects, you are afraid to go into projects, but he has walked through it? What kind of fear can you put in him that will start to match that? Or somebody beating him up? And many of our youngsters have seen violence like you can't even imagine. So that is not the way to do it. It has to be a different way. You have to do it through support and love and understanding and counseling.
Now, there were outside problems that your kids had that you often took on yourself as principal. For instance, one morning there was a student who showed up in front of the school with a scalded arm, not knowing what to do.
Yeah, that's a sad situation. Here was a youngster who was about 7, 8 years old, whose mother was retarded to any given eye. You could just look at her and talk with her 2 minutes, and you knew that she needed help. And this youngster had been cooking the night before with the mother and burned his arm. Grease, hot grease had scalded his arm. He came to school. When I got there at 7:30 because my daughter took a bus from our school to her school. So I got there at 7:30. He was there at 7:30 with this arm, and it was scalded away. I mean, you could just see it was burned away. So he wasn't crying. He was just sitting there waiting for me to come. So when I got there, I called the school community coordinator. I said, look at this boy's arm. Go get his mother. Because you have to have his mother in order to take him to the hospital. So she went and got his mother, took him and his mother to the hospital, and had his arm attended to. But I looked at that and I saw that boy was able to get through the night and to be sitting there because he knew that come morning, I was going to be there and get help for him. And you think of the youngster who is in a situation like that, who has no light at the end of the tunnel.
Some of the advice you gave the teachers was, you said, never say to one of the students, doing your homework tonight is your priority.
Yeah.
What's wrong with saying that?
Okay. You might could say that to a child. And we said it to them. I said it to them. But you had to know that when that child came back the next morning and his homework wasn't done, you had to look into why his homework wasn't done. You couldn't stand in front of the classroom with a blanket. Anybody doesn't have his homework, I'm going to do this, that, and that, and the other. Or you're not interested in school. You had to look at if this youngster doesn't have his homework, and we have told him that homework must be a priority. Because in a child's life, homework should be the first priority. But many of our children were not living the lives of children. They were taking care of little kids, taking care of their mother, taking care of the house, taking care of themselves, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. So that in their lives, homework wasn't first.
Now, how does a teacher with 30 kids in the class try to assess whether somebody didn't do their homework because they're just being lazy and therefore she needs to try to either, you know, discipline them a little bit or be more encouraging for them to do their homework? The difference between that and someone who didn't do their homework because
it's a whole picture.
All hell was breaking loose at home that night.
It's a whole picture. You know, you begin to look at a youngster and you see that this youngster is not a child. He is not happy and playing and reaching on the table, tickling somebody. It becomes a picture. You can see who the children are who are living children's lives, and you can see who the children are who have the responsibility of adults.
As a principal, part of what you did in the elementary school was you brought in a washing machine, a dryer, a sewing machine. You took care of kids. You kept them clean. You washed their clothes. And when I say you, I mean you and your staff and your teachers and so on. Is this the kind of things schools need to do now in order to succeed? I mean, is this what you're recommending, that all principals should bring in washing machines and dryers? Is that what we need now?
I'm saying that the school needs to bring into the school what is needed. In that building, we needed a washer and a dryer. I think there has to be a coming together of the social agencies, the welfare department, the health department. They need to come together in the school. I don't mean visit the school. I think they need to move into the school. If a welfare worker has 100 cases and there are 100 cases in the school, and that's what they have in Philadelphia, the health welfare workers have 100 cases. I called and asked them. I found out they have 100 cases. I found I had 600 kids. I said, I'm due 3-4 welfare workers. Rather than giving me a welfare worker who has a kid in this school, that school, and that school, and that school, give me a welfare worker and let her get all of our cases out of my school. And let me have them right here so they can learn to know the children as I know them, learn to know the parents as I know them. Have the health agency right here. If we hire a dentist, does that dentist carry more than 650 kids? If he doesn't, then give me my dentist. Give me mine right here in the school. If the doctor takes care of in the health department, if he takes care of 600 children, if I have 600, give me my doctor. Bring it all right here so everybody can begin to intermingle with each other, interact with each other, and serve the children and their families.
So you're saying, yes, the schools need to become part of the social...
Part of the whole
social welfare system.
It all has to come together because it's the whole child we're talking about. We're talking about teaching the whole child. We're talking about holistic teaching. We're talking about holistic living and bring the child together so he can live.
Madeline Cartwright, I thank you very, very much for sharing some of your experiences with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Madeline Cartwright is the author of For the Children. She just retired from the Philadelphia school system. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.